Alexander Wales.
And this is episode 21, World Building Social Systems.
Part 1, Top Down.
Right. This will probably be a two-part episode. So this one, we're just going to be talking about top-down world building. Why don't you go ahead and explain what that is?
Okay. So in top-down world building, you basically have an idea of what you want to talk about. What kind of commentary you want to make on modern politics or on some aspect of identity or social science or something like that. And then you find some kind of analog and you make your story about that. So you start from this high level, you know, we're going to talk about being transgender. And so you find a social system or something that you want to talk about explicitly. And you want to talk about homosexuality or religion or corporatism or whatever. And then you go and you decide that you're going to make a world that lets you talk about that sort of in a metaphorical way. And so you're basically starting from that viewpoint. Like you're saying, okay, I want to talk about wage slavery. And so I'm gonna build from that perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas bottom up, you make a rule and then you say, okay, what comes out of that rule? You start at that very low level, and you can do a mix of both. I'm not gonna say that you can't, but
I mean, you might come up with something explicit to start with, and you say, you know, I want to talk about the evils of capitalism or the evils of communism in a fantasy setting, and then you also happen to add in some magic system or something like that that's, you know, just part of the setting. And as you go about exploring that magic system, you realize that you're also telling the story about persecution of people with special abilities, or you're talking about the, you know, unfairness inherent to births, like how people are born with certain abilities over others or things like that.
Yeah. So this is a very, very common thing that you see in science fiction, because people really like science fiction for social commentary.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do. Some people are just in it for the ray guns and
right.
You know, green-skinned space aliens or whatever. But a lot of science fiction writers and a lot of science fiction moviegoers are in it for the sort of allegory.
Yeah.
So you get your, like, Brave New World or Fahrenheit 451 was a very... It wasn't about censorship, or it was... This is one of those Death of the Author things. Ray Bradbury did not intend it to be a message about censorship.
Right, it was the evils of television or something, right?
Yeah, it was about people's short attention spans, right? That no one is going to read books anymore because they have TV. And they're going to have these TVs that are on all four walls of their home, so they can just, like, sit in their couch, watch TV.
And have their brain melted by...
Just absorb.
Yeah.
Yeah, in this short attention span type of way.
And he wrote this, for those of you who don't know, this book was written a long time ago.
Yeah, 50s or 60s.
So these books often are considered literature. We're going to have an episode at one point about the distinction between literature and speculative fiction. But literature, like Fahrenheit 451, is science fiction, but it's considered literature in part because of its age, but also in part because, I guess, the social commentary, right? The fact that it is such a landmark book, especially also books like 1984.
1984 is like the oppressive totalitarian government.
Mm-hmm.
And that's its driving focus, and the entire world is built to sort of highlight that and talk about it. This concept of newspeak, that we're going to, you know, alter our language so as to suppress certain thoughts.
And the concept that with technology, the government's power to invade everyone's everyday life is going to grow to the point of dystopia.
Yeah. And there's actually, it's kind of interesting because people read it today and they sort of gloss over some of the world building stuff that wasn't plausible really at the time that it was written. So they have these view screens that are in everyone's like bedroom, and these view screens also function as video cameras.
Right. But
they don't ever talk about video cameras, and video cameras at the time were these huge things. And so this telescreen is a combination, and having a camera that small at the time was sort of...
It was science fiction. That's,
yeah.
This is the setting that it was written in was like today we would write science fiction and come up with all sorts of technology that we might extrapolate might someday exist, but definitely don't in today's world. This is what they were doing back then, and it's become not just hallowed ground, but like kind of a redeeming for a lot of people who aren't really into speculative fiction. It's kind of the redeeming value of science fiction, that it can help you explore social situations and things like that with a future bent that reflects on our modern day. You know, talk about modern issues by extrapolating into the future.
Yeah. And I think that the reason that literary people love it so much is because literary people love allegory.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a particular fondness for magical realism, which we've talked about before. But I think that they enjoy the social commentary for the same reason they enjoy magical realism. Sort of striking at an issue from an odd angle.
Right.
And you get at it a little better. But yeah, 1984, these view screens are basically the only bit of science fictional technology, really. Like, they don't have computers at all. They just have people listening in.
Yeah.
Physically. And everything else, but George Orwell needed this device to sort of get the point across about everyone being watched all the time. And so he invented these telescreens in, like, 1948. The sort of unimaginable technology to punctuate the thing that he wanted to get at. And then the counterpoint, or what's often today taught as the counterpoint to 1984, is Brave New World, which is about conformity and, to some extent, the secularization. It sort of rails against science in quite a few places. Everyone's born into these castes, and it's test tube babies, and people take all these pills to make themselves feel better. And
yeah, it basically conflates science with unnaturalism, and the hero at some point, you know, finds a pristine part of the world, and it does the whole noble savage thing where people were happier in the pre-technological age, the pre-organized society age kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is another common refrain of science fiction in a lot of older stories, maybe still some new ones. I haven't really read it that often nowadays, but it was the idea of using the idea of what the future might be like to say that the past was better.
The biggest recent example is the movie Avatar.
Right. Yeah, Ferngully Part 2.
Yeah. And that is a wonderful example of top-down world-building. Because it wasn't like someone came and was like, okay, I'm going to invent all these rules, and then the story just naturally arises out of that. No, it was someone who wanted to make a distinct point about environmental catastrophe and military-industrial complex. And I mean, it was more ham-fisted than that, but...
Right, by wonderful example, I assume you mean it was a wonderful example of that type of story and not a wonderful story.
Yeah, it was not a wonderful story, but when I'm dividing these up into top-down and bottom-up...
Yeah, probably one of the most popular science fiction movies that hit the big screens in a while, before the Star Wars things ratcheted back up anyway. And I think part of that was the visual effects, but I also think part of it is, again, that like it was selling this message that is, you know, very in vogue, especially amongst liberal audiences these days, of the military bad, corporatism bad, naturalism good, native oppression bad, that kind of thing. And so, like, you know, it's a way to tell a story that you want, and it doesn't have to be as heavy-handed or anvilicious as Avatar was, but it's definitely a way, when you're planning out your story, to decide what social issues you're going to tackle and build the story around them.
Yeah. So some other examples, there's a Justin Timberlake movie called In Time. I don't know if you saw this.
Yes.
Everyone has a limited amount of lifespan that like shows up on their wrist, and you have to work to get more, and your lifespan is basically replaced currency. And this is not, I mean, that's an interesting idea as a starting point,
mm-hmm.
right? If you were going to do bottom up, I think that would work a lot better than how it did work in the film. Because in the film, it's very much, you know, rich people are hoarding all the wealth and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they just wanted, I don't want to be uncharitable here, but it felt to me like they just wanted to talk about wealth and income inequality.
Yes.
And things like that. And they built this conceit around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a few aspects to the society where I felt like, if this had actually happened, I don't think it would quite shape up this way. It might still be dysfunctional and dystopian, but I don't think it would come out quite this way. They're working too hard to make it parallel today's world, instead of from the bottom up exploring what the consequences of these ideas would be on society. And as top-down movies go, I don't want to say that I'm trying to think of what I would consider a good top-down movie. District 9?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love District 9. I thought that was a fantastic film.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is, I mean, it's not entirely about apartheid, but it's mostly about that.
It tackles the us versus them idea in terms of apartheid, in terms of immigration, in many ways. You know, like, it's very much on the idea of race relations.
Yeah. And I mean, it was made by a South African filmmaker in South Africa, which I think made the parallel a lot more clear.
Mm-hmm.
The slums of Johannesburg are basically, you're replacing the downtrodden people in the slums of Johannesburg with these aliens. And it's sort of used to sort of humanize them, I guess, but also to talk about some of the difficulties and show this transition. But as far as world building goes, it's very thin on a lot of the main stuff. Why this spaceship is there.
Yeah. I haven't watched the movie since it came out. I really should, because I want to rewatch it with a rational lens, which I didn't quite have back then. When I first saw it, I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was a great movie. But there were a few things that bothered me, obviously. And one of them was, I felt like the problem the aliens had would not continue past the... I felt like there would at least be one culture on the planet that saw it as a good idea to treat the aliens well and invite them to their country and basically be like, hey, you know, share your technology with us and you can be citizens or whatever. Maybe, like, that wouldn't have happened. Like, maybe there would have been some conflict about that. Maybe there's a whole bunch of reasons why that didn't happen. But I remember watching it and thinking, like, you know, realistically speaking, these aliens I feel like these aliens are being treated way worse than they should be by the world at large, not necessarily by individuals, because I think individuals definitely would be that discriminatory. But yeah, top down, because there was an idea that clearly they wanted to talk about, and they used science fiction setting to do it in a great way.
Yeah, and I think the last one that I want to talk about before we talk about, like, how do you successfully go about mm-hmm. doing top down world building? Last one I want to talk about is X-Men, which is not, I don't think, is actually an example of top down world building, except that you have the X-Men movies, which are.
Yes.
Which, you know, someone says, hey, I want to talk about discrimination against gays, and I'm going to use this world that exists as a vehicle to do that.
It might have been...
And then change things as necessary to make that sort of fit.
It might have been more of a middle out kind of thing.
Yeah.
I've talked before about how much I love Magneto's character in the movies. I feel like he is far and away the best part of all the movies that he's ever been in. And the fact that he transitions from a Jew in the Holocaust to a champion of gay rights, essentially, you know, analogous champion of gay rights, because he knows what it is to be discriminated against. It ties in beautifully well, right? Because when he's talking about discrimination against mutants, the parallel doesn't have to be explicit. It's so obvious that everyone gets it. You mentioned the joke in the, I think it was the second movie?
It was the first.
The first one? Try not being a mutant? Was that it? Are you sure it was the first one? I thought it was the second one when they were with Iceman's parents.
Yeah, first one was Iceman.
Mm-mm. No, first one was Rogue.
Yeah, it was Rogue and Iceman and the Fire Guy.
That was the second one, buddy.
Okay, you're probably right. You are right.
They escape the mansion because it was under attack, and they go to his house to, like, for shelter temporarily, and he comes out to his parents.
Yeah, but that whole coming out scene there
was
very strictly an analogy to coming out as gay. And
it was great. It was brilliantly done.
Yeah, I thought it was very funny.
Yeah, absolutely. But
at the same time, I'm like, you know, there are legitimate reasons for people to be afraid of mutants.
Yeah, I think we've touched on this too, right? Like,
yeah.
Not to say, you know, that that's the best way for a society to act towards mutants, but it's definitely less of a groundless fear. I don't think I'm being particularly brave by saying that fear of homosexuals is groundless and irrational and stupid. But
yeah.
For mutants, I think there's a little bit more of a justification to be like, you know, maybe we should pay attention to this difference in people.
Yeah.
So for what makes a good top-down movie?
Yeah, or a story in general.
Mm-hmm. District 9 was really great, and I liked it a lot, and I need to rewatch it, but I think it was a solid movie when I watched it the first time. Elysium was not.
Yeah.
This Elysium was by the same director, and same thing, it was science fiction, it was creator definitely wanted to tell a story about capitalism and the one percenters, or in this case the 0.0001 percenters, all living in a technological utopia in space, while automation basically turned Earth into a slave wage factory where no one really had any power or wealth at all, and everyone was just working to themselves to death to get meager scraps. And, you know, great topics to touch on. If you want to tell that story, go ahead. I'm all for it. But this particular movie was really poorly done in this case, I think. Like, even though it was preaching to the choir in my case, I felt like I was rolling my eyes out of my head the whole time I was watching it, because there were just so many things that, to the movie's credit, it's purposefully bending things to an extreme. Like, it knows that it's bending things to an extreme when it's doing so. But I think that's the danger of writing a top-down story and trying to do it well. Because our world has plenty of extreme and moderate and in-between examples of social ills and social problems. And when you strawman, it's not that the strawman literally doesn't exist, right? Like, you can find people who literally will say, you know, I don't care if you and your whole family starve as long as I get 1% extra off my taxes or something. Like, I've met these people. They exist. But if you're building a story around the concept and you want to explore it, you lose a lot if that's all that exists. And in Elysium, that's really all that existed. We had evil rich people for the sake of evil. No explanation as to why their wealth could not be shared, or if there was any attempt to share the wealth or magical life-saving science. Like, there was no indication that anyone was like, oh, we would love to be able to have everyone have access to this cancer removing life-saving machinery, but it works on unobtainium, and, you know, we can't just give it away, otherwise we'd run out. You know, something like that. It just, even throwaway lines like that would be enough to show that the top-down approach is not being used as an anvil to drop your idea on people.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the places where you have to be conscious of medium, because I think it's so much harder to do throwaway world-building lines to justify in a movie,
mm-hmm.
where you can't, you know, every, you know, if your movie costs $90 million to make, basically every minute of screen time is $1 million. And that's not unrealistic. It's not actually $1 million for each minute of screen time, but it's a ton of money,
mm-hmm.
and it's a ton of time on set. And then you're trying to keep the audience engaged. And the more that you're adding in complexity, you might lose some audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's so much easier to do that in, like, prose fiction, when you can just, like, drop a whole scene in and no one will be like, oh, you know, I'm going to bail out now. But yeah, Elysium was very, even if you take it as an analogy to sweatshop conditions in the third world and how the first world interacts with the third world, it's a very black and white portrayal of that. And some anvils need to be dropped, sure, mm-hmm. but you sacrifice something if you're going to be that heavy-handed about it.
Right. Being right is no excuse for bad art.
Yeah. So in general, let's say that you have some social issue that you want to talk about, right? What are the ways that you get to a top-down approach? I don't know if you ever do, like, top-down
mm-hmm.
writing, but
honestly, I can't say that I have. I feel like plotting is probably my weakest aspect as a writer. Like, one of the things I love about my Pokemon story is that I've got the plot in mind. It's really there. It's vivid, which is great for me. But generally speaking, I don't go into things with a plot in mind. I go into things with a character or setting or idea in mind and just kind of let it build upward. So I don't really have experience being like, I want to tell a story about this, and then working my way down to see how I would do that. I think the closest thing to that I've done is when there are certain things that I want to do in a story that will touch upon social issues. So, for example, in the Pokemon story, there's going to be a collectivist versus individualist conflict that's going to come up. And I'm thinking about ways that I'm going to put that in the story, and what I want to obviously avoid doing is make it too transparent and scene-stealing. But what I want to do is have characters that naturally exemplify the virtues of both. Put them in the setting and have them interact organically. And I think that's what I would say is probably the first most important thing, is that if you want to talk about something in your story, it's probably going to have a conflicting side to it, right? You're going to have someone who either disagrees with it, or is on the opposite side of it, or believes in something very different from it that isn't compatible. If you can fully actualize that character as well, and not just your mouthpiece for one thing or the other, it helps a lot, because then you've got a much more organic interaction between the ideas that you want to talk about, instead of having everything center on one or the other.
Yeah.
What about you? Like, what do you do for Top Down, really? Metropolitan Man?
Metropolitan Man was me wanting to write a Superman story that was more of what I wanted than I was getting out of Superman. I think most fan fiction that I've written has been that kind of thing.
Right. I like this concept, but they're doing it wrong. I need to make something better.
Right. There's this kind of schlocky show on NBC called Timeless. And I am kind of halfway in the process of writing a fanfic of it. And it's like these people are chasing this guy through time, and he's trying to like upset American history, and they're trying to fix it.
Right, you've mentioned this before. Yeah, it's very frustrating watching it, so you've been, I guess you've been feeling more and more inclined to do it yourself?
Yeah, because that seems like the perfect springboard to write about, like, what is America?
Mm-hmm.
What is the nature of this America that you're trying to save?
Right.
If the bad guy goes back in time and he's trying to stop slavery from ever happening like 100 years early, do you go and stop him because that slavery is part of American history?
Right.
Or, you know, there are all these moral conflicts that they don't explore, and that in a way is top-down approach, because I see so clearly the social issue this dynamic feels like it's meant to be built around. But I think for the most part I kind of do from the middle. I think it's usually I come up with an idea, and then I think to myself, what are the natural stories that come out of this? And then once I find a story that I really like, that I think says something, then I'll world build the rest of it around that. So, like, there's a story that's not out yet and might never come out, but it's about the technology is developed to capture people's brain states and sort of run simulations of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the story then is about this sort of fading celebrity starlet who uploads her mind and it, quote, leaks, unquote, onto the internet to bump her fame under the advice of her manager. And it's sort of a parallel to, like, leaked sex tapes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way of talking about that and then, like, amplifying it, because it's your mind and it's sort of about fame, because you're sort of giving yourself to your audience, and then all these people are talking about you and inspecting you and things like that.
Right.
And so that's very much a work of top-down world building, because if you want to talk about those things, you have to have certain constraints on your world so that any of that makes sense, right?
Yeah, and this is a problem I think that a lot of people have sometimes with top-down world building. They have an idea for their story, and as they're writing their story about their idea, things start popping up that kind of derail things and make it so that they're, like, the perfect ending they have in mind to drive their point home starts to make less sense. Characters around the main character don't really have enough motivation or agency to feel real. Just overall, the story starts to suffer for the purity or vigor of the idea that they want to communicate through their story, right?
Yeah.
And instead of, like, adapting to that, they have trouble killing their darlings, as it's put. They have trouble realizing that, you know, this scene isn't really necessary, or this speech isn't necessary, or this is something that I'm interested in, but the story could use less of.
This is one of the reasons that I tend to write. This is one of the reasons I like to write fantasy more than science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're writing a science fiction story and you say, okay, people have these brain states that can be captured by, like, fMRI or whatever, and then they build up this model of you, and then it can be run in a computer, and people can talk to you and interact with you, and it's horrifying and whatever. You have that as your premise. There's so many other things, technological things, that come from that. Like, if the average desktop computer can run your brain, that changes everything about economics and intellectual property, and you have to use a hammer very liberally to get the world back into a shape where you want to talk about modern day issues. Whereas if you do it in fantasy, you can just have some kind of mental power or whatever that works in the way that you want to talk about without all these knock-on effects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, less of them. Brain states are not a great example, but if you're writing fantasy and you want to talk about digital rights management, you can add that into Magic and then talk about it in this sort of, from this awkward angle that illuminates more.
Yeah, and it's a good distinction to draw between science fiction and fantasy in terms of which ones are more, I don't want to say amenable to certain ideas or issues, but I feel like they do have their strengths and weaknesses for tackling one or the other.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just a result of the ones that I've read. Speculative fiction in general is, you know, has that power of introducing new concepts to talk in metaphors, but I really like modern supernatural fiction that has the masquerade down, by which I mean people know about the monsters and the magicians and all the special creatures and beings that exist, because it introduces that idea, in good ones anyway, it introduces that idea of, like, what does society do with the existence of vampires and werewolves and witches and whatnot? Like, how do they, kind of like the X-Men thing, like, how do they function as out or in, or in the closet, or how do they get representation if they need representation in government? How does law enforcement deal with them? The Anita Blake series is probably the first modern supernatural series that I read that really delved into that kind of stuff, and I loved it. And I feel like that's done better with, I don't want to say it's done better with modern supernatural than other genres, but I feel like you have to do so much more work in a completely unique fantasy setting.
Yeah.
When if that's the kind of story you want to tell, you don't need to make a completely unique fantasy setting, because those are things that we have, you know, more than enough background with and context with in our world. And introducing new third parties, new outsiders, so to speak, kind of blends in seamlessly with, like, the civil rights era and the fight for equal rights and social equality and all that kind of stuff. So you can either do the, like, retroactive historical thing, where you talk about, like, maybe the first werewolf that was out was some U.S. president, and, like, it kicked off a firestorm, and people, like, were arguing in the streets about how monster as president and, like, what it meant for identity politics or whatever. Like, just, you know, you can do that kind of thing where you go back in time and readjust how things went. Or you can just say, like, modern time, bam, 2016, something comes up, and now how does the world deal with it?
Yeah. I think that science fiction is really good for talking about technological issues. And that's almost where I'd end with it. I mean, if you want to talk about a surveillance state, then yeah, you're almost certainly going to want to do a science fictional world, right?
Mm-hmm.
Minority Report was about the surveillance state to some extent, and there are these precogs. And that is a really good way of exploring the surveillance state, because you're not talking about these specific little details that just sort of get in the way. Right? Because mm-hmm. if we're talking about modern surveillance state, and we're talking about certain types of, like, thermal imaging that can look inside your home, and is that an unreasonable search, or do you have an expectation of privacy, or we're talking about modern camera systems, and that, yeah, they're all in public places, or whatever. It's going a step further, and then it's going in a direction that we're never actually going to have to face. And so, in that way, it's better to talk about it. I mean, you can make this distinction of, are precognitives actually science fiction, or are they fantasy? But generally, I prefer my sci-fi that's social commentary to be talking about technological things rather than, you know, social things.
Mm-hmm. Or at least things that can be related back to technological things, like things that are basically talking about technological things under different guise.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that psychic powers are almost always considered sci-fi is because they tend to show up in modern or futuristic kind of stories, whereas you don't really get a lot of, like, old-timey fantasy settings that have, like, no real magic or anything like that, but psychics. Like, you don't really have a Game of Thrones setting with just psychics as the only special thing about it. So psychics tend to show up in a kind of mix between modern or futuristic settings. So it's more likely considered a sci-fi thing. But it can go both ways. Like, you know, you can definitely have psychics as part of a whole modern horror supernatural kind of thing.
Yeah. There's this Playboy story that was published 40, 50 years ago or something like that, where this man and this woman are in this society run by gays, and they're meeting in secret at this, like, not a straight bar necessarily, but at this place where straight people go to meet up and have these covert clandestine affairs and stuff, and then they get captured by the gay police. And they got so many complaints about that because people were like, well, you know, why are you, like, showing, you know, this is, like, a horrible story. And then Hugh Hefner's response was basically, well, can you imagine if it were straight people who were in charge and gay people were persecuted, which was basically the entire point of the story.
Right, right.
Flip perspectives. And I think that's the direction that I want Top Down to go.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hit harder because it's coming from this place of metaphor and allegory that can be very, very powerful, specifically because it's crafted just to deliver this message or at least examine this topic.
Yeah, and it's effective because it, like, sneaks past your radar. It's like satire. It gets at your ideas in a way that you're not used to having them confronted.
Yeah, so long as it's not getting to be a direct parallel, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought that that scene in X-Men where he comes out as a mutant, I thought that was very funny.
Mm-hmm.
One of the only things that stuck out to me about from that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was very, not ham-fisted necessarily, but it made the analogy a little too clear.
I think it was definitely included for the sake of humor, that line in particular, right? But at the same time, I agree that they were definitely doing it to make it clear as they possibly could what the analogy was. I mean, I think the scene was good in part because it also included, like, the fear,
yeah,
in the from the family when he reached out and froze the coffee or whatever it was in the cup, and it was such an innocuous thing, right? He just kind of reached out and they just wanted to show them what he could do, and he froze the cup and its contents, and they reacted like he just, like, grew a third head and started climbing on the wall. And not also a thing that mutants could do is climb on walls, but I mean, like, you know, as if he just froze one of them. And that's the point, obviously, that he could, and that's what's scary about it. But it communicated both, like, why the scene in total communicated both, I think, like, why people are afraid of mutants, but also the willful ignorance of certain people in understanding that people are who they are, and accepting who people are.
Yeah. I also thought it was one of the few moments in the X-Men movies as a whole that we get someone talking to a normal person.
Uh-huh.
Who's not, like, an authority figure or, you know, a corporate tycoon.
You're right, yeah. As boring as it might sound in terms of, like, X-Men deal with family problems. Like, I mean, that's what a lot of the episodes in the TV shows and cartoons were, I think. But I would have enjoyed more of that in the movies, opposed to mutants punching and shooting at each other.
Yeah.
Which was fun enough in some of them, but not others.
Yeah. So, do you have any tips for Top Down?
Yeah. Besides the idea of actualizing individuals, doing your best to model what someone who disagrees with the concepts you want to tell your story about. This kind of is a principle of rational storytelling, right, where you don't want... It's not that you don't want good guys and bad guys. You can have good guys and bad guys in your story. You can have good and evil, quote-unquote, people in your story. But you want conflicts to arise from perceivable discord in values, not just because he's good and he's evil. Therefore, they must fight, right?
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the first thing that I would say is what I would advise anyone who has an idea for a top-down kind of story that they want to talk about. If there's some social concept or political concept or moral concept that you want to talk about in your story, make sure that you include a character of the opposite ideology. They don't have to be a good guy if you don't want them to be, but, like, at least somewhat make them sympathetic enough that they can be real people. Don't make them just the worst example of that thing, because you're going to have a harder time, I think, convincing people who disagree with you. You're going to turn people off in your story. Your story is going to suffer for it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, people should be driven into conflict by their values.
Yeah.
So
Avatar definitely did not do this. I'm pretty sure just every single bad guy in that movie was, like, puppy-kicking levels of evil.
Yeah. So I think one of the big things is, if you're doing the top-down approach, you're taking a map to a territory, and you're using that map for a different territory. And the real key is finding the proper metaphor. And that's very difficult to do.
Right.
And it depends on specifically what you want to talk about. And so, like, if you want to talk about nuclear proliferation and mutually assured destruction and things like that. Finding a territory that maps to that is difficult unless you want a different, like, world-ending power.
Right.
Although I've seen that done very frequently, that, you know, there's some doomsday device, and then they use that doomsday device to talk about the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Vonnegut does that in...
Cat's Cradle?
Cat's Cradle, mm-hmm. Yeah. Cat's Cradle has Ice Nine, which would, like, freeze all the oceans and stuff, and the military develops it just... They developed it to freeze over swamps, so they could cross them easily. And it's, you know, it's Vonnegut, so it's not... It's sort of fanciful in its way. But, yeah, you can talk about time travel proliferation. You can talk in, like, a fantasy setting about...
Demons.
You can talk about demons. There was one particular hack used in Two-Year Emperor that they talk about very much like it's a... Like it's a nuclear weapon. Like it's the secret that they need to keep from other people as soon as it's discovered, because it would destroy the world if anyone could do it.
Right.
Finding that new territory to map onto and then making it different enough so that it's interesting and sort of disconnects from that specific talk mm-hmm. about the issue while still being recognizable. Because presumably if you are doing this... You want people to get the metaphor that you're driving at.
Right.
You don't just want to go... You don't want them to, like, be thinking about it weeks and weeks later, and they're like, oh, they were talking, you know, they were talking about this political issue. That makes sense.
I remember Morrowind did something like this. The video game Morrowind, Elder Scrolls 3, did something like this that I really enjoyed, where... And you're doing character creation, and the person, as soon as you step off the boat, this guy starts asking you questions to see what kind of person you are. And one of the questions they ask is, like, the king has mind mages, you know, in his employ, and they go around basically, you know, talking to people innocuously and seeing if they are enemies of the state. And it basically says, you know, how do you feel about this? And there's some options you can choose from. One of them is, like, you know, it's perfectly fine. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Another option might be, like, you know, it makes me uncomfortable, but I guess whatever the safety of the people is more important than my individual feelings. And the third one is, you know, no, this is a terrible breach of privacy. My mind is my own. Things like that. And even as, I don't know, I was like maybe 12 or 13 or something. Like, even at that age, I recognized what it was talking about. Using the idea of mind mages and psychics to talk about privacy in modern times and
yeah.
a surveillance state and 1984 kind of stuff.
Yeah, the sort of post 9/11
mm-hmm.
type mentality. Yeah, if you are trying to write a story that is about one of those issues, you want to find something. You want to find the right story for it.
Right.
Don't just land on the first thing that you come across. And to some extent, I would suggest not doing top down at all.
Mm-hmm.
Just do a sort of middle approach. Or start from bottom up and find the natural stories. But, you know, maybe there's something that you're really passionate about and you really want to talk about. Then I think you're fine to go gung-ho on that.
Right,
for me,
right.
There's so many things that I want to talk about that it's not that hard for me to find one of them.
Mm-hmm. And these are hard things to do. I don't think anyone should be discouraged if they're trying to do them and struggling with them. Finding a good metaphor is difficult for a lot of issues. The world is a complex place. Nothing maps. Very few things map one to one directly from one thing to another. You know, like the idea of, for example, the idea of the psychics versus state surveillance. One could say that state surveillance could have checks and balances in place to make sure that sensitive information is not being misused and has like lots of oversight and blah de blah de blah. That things that are very idealistic and probably would not actually happen if they were implemented, and I don't believe. Do happen if implemented, but you could make the argument that, like, if done well enough, maybe it's an okay thing in certain circumstances. Whereas for psychics, very difficult to have any kind of checks and balances when it's individuals who have the power to look into people's minds, then tell other people what they read there.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can try again. You can try to come up with ways to justify the metaphor and make it more equivalent if you work at it. It takes time. It takes effort. Same with the modeling people from both sides thing. Like, if you're having trouble with it, find someone that you're on somewhat friendly terms with, or just, you know, go on Reddit or something and ask in a subreddit with people of the other ideology. Say, you know, I'm writing a story about a character that believes this and this thing. I'm not really familiar with it. Let me know if this sounds okay. You know, get feedback on the character that you're modeling so that you can make sure that it properly represents the people that you're talking about or the ideology that you're talking about.
Yeah, I've got this Hermione Draco slash fic that I'm writing, and it is so much about race relations.
Mm-hmm.
So I went on some like white nationalists or white supremacist message boards, mm-hmm. and I was like, okay, how do these people actually talk/think? And then I just used some of that stuff for like Draco Malfoy talking about like the gaps in test scores between muggles and full-blooded wizards.
Mm-hmm.
Or muggle-born full-blooded wizards. Do your research, because especially if you're explicitly trying to talk about a specific social issue, you want to know what both sides are saying, even if you think one of them is very wrong.
Mm-hmm. So I think that does it for top-down world-building for now. Next episode, we'll talk about bottom-up, emergent conflicts and ideas that come about from writing the story, mapping out the characters and their interactions.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. Stay tuned after the outro music for another book recommendation. Hope you join us next week. Hey everyone, today's book recommendation is going to be for The Long Walk by Stephen King. We talked a lot about top-down stories being about political or social issues that the author wants to explore through their fiction, but that's not the only form they can take. Top-down storytelling can also result from a central premise that has less to do with any particular message or idea, and more to do with the theme you want to evoke or the plot you want to explore. Stephen King is a master of this, often so laser-focused on the theme or tone, or what-if, that his world-building is left to a bare minimum. Sometimes that what-if is, what if a whole town got slowly turned into monsters but retained their sense of self throughout? Other times that what-if is, what if a husband and wife go to a cabin for some kinky sex but he has a stroke while she's handcuffed to the bed? The Long Walk is probably my favorite of these, in part because of how simple it is. What if 100 boys had to walk for as long as they could, with the last one standing winning a prize, and everyone else getting killed? King could have spent pages and pages talking about the dystopian state that America has turned into, where such a grisly game is a celebrated national event. But he doesn't care about any of that, and through the power of his writing and characters, soon neither will you. All that matters are these 100 young men who, over the course of a few exhausting, endless days, will walk themselves to death, side by side, knowing that only one of them will survive, knowing that it's better not to form any bonds with their competitors, but helpless not to. The Long Walk was written all the way back in 1979, predating both The Hunger Games and its inspiration, Battle Royale, for death game stories. It's not for everyone, but I personally love the book, and recommend it to anyone interested in seeing how an author can get away with as little world building as possible, focusing the story with a razor focus on just the idea they built their plot around. If you want to give it a listen, head on over to www.audibletrial.com/rational to get a free 30-day trial and book a credit, or check out the link in the show notes to buy the novel. Thanks for listening.